This Marketplace podcast is supported by Equinix, the world's digital infrastructure company. Looking for the choice and control of hardware with the low overhead and developer experience of the cloud? Deploy Equinix Metal in minutes across 18 global locations, from Silicon Valley to Sydney. Just add Metal at metal.equinix.com.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Over 10 million people trust Wise when they send, spend, and receive money across borders. Wise always gives you the real exchange rate and super low fees. Try it for free at wise.com/marketplace.
Okay, once again, but for reals this time. What is Jay Powell thinking? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, this one is the 20th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, the politics of this economy can be messy, and we know that because politics. But we lead today with a story in that messy orbit because it could have some big ripple effects. Last month, Rob Kaplan, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and Eric Rosengren, the president of the Boston Fed, resigned after disclosures about securities trading they did last year raised questions about ethics at the central bank. Since then, the Fed has announced an independent review of trading by Fed officials. But this week, Fed Chair Jay Powell's own financial disclosures have raised some more eyebrows. Rachel Siegel covers the Fed. She has been on this story for The Washington Post. Rachel, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
What have we learned then about Chair Powell's disclosure forms?
So Chair Powell's disclosure forms are distinct from what we know about Robert Kaplan and Eric Rosengren. But nevertheless, you know, it is worth looking at the transactions that he made last year. For example, we know that he had 26 transactions on his disclosure form last year. 19 were for automatic dividend reinvestments, basically transactions put on autopilot. He had 6 withdrawals, which the Fed has told us were for family expenses. And for example, one of them was quite large. On October 1st, he had a sale of a Vanguard stock market index fund that was valued between $1 million and $5 million.
Does it matter, and how relevant is it, that he was selling into a falling market?
It's a question that we're thinking about, too. On the one hand, you should say it shouldn't matter whether or not someone ends up making or losing money. And unless they're fortune tellers, they don't necessarily know which way the market is going to go. At the same time, if anyone has a pulse on what's happening deep within the financial system, it's the Fed chair. And so, you know, in some ways, we have to try to answer these questions independent of what was actually happening in the market and thinking about the kind of information that the person actually held at the time that they were making it.
These trades for all three men were in accordance, we are told, with Federal Reserve ethics guidelines, yes?
That's right. And one important place where it's also important to distinguish Powell's financial history from Kaplan and Rosengren is that there is this ongoing inspector general investigation into whether Kaplan and Rosengren's conduct complied with the Fed ethics rules and the law. So I tend to think of it as sort of two layers. There is a question of whether certain behavior violated Fed ethics rules and the law. And then this question of, okay, well, here's what lots of other people were doing. And does this tell us anything about the way the rules should be improved moving forward?
So in his last press conference that Chair Powell did after their most recent meeting, the chairman was asked about Rosengren and Kaplan. And he said, in essence, we're all really disappointed. And nobody wants the Federal Reserve to be in this position. How do you think all of this then plays into the conversations that are being had about Chair Powell's renomination, which the White House has to decide on reasonably soon? He's up in February.
Sure. So as far as I can tell, these debates about Fed stock trading scandals, these ethics rules, have not, you know, shifted the calculus in terms of whether or not the White House is going to renominate Powell or not. However, I think what is related is that these questions have really complicated the Fed's public trust. So I tend to think about it as less whether this will completely change the game about Powell's chances at a second term and more the Fed's broader public perception at a time where it really needs the confidence of the American people.
I was talking to Mary Daly of the San Francisco Fed 2 weeks ago, and she said trust is all we've got. That's the whole deal.
It is. And you know, it's worth remembering that we're in this moment where people are feeling higher prices and some people have not yet been able to get back into jobs. And now they're dealing with this additional layer of ethics. And that really just complicates this, you know, the mission really that they have set out to do.
Let me ask you to, and this might not be fair, but I'm going to try it anyway. Put on your I'm a reporter in Washington, D.C., so I'm attuned to politics. And ask you about the politics of the chair's potential renomination, because Elizabeth Warren on the Senate Banking Committee has already come out in opposition to Chair Powell. She wants more regulation of banks than he has been willing to do. There's a progressive caucus in the House, which, of course, does not get a vote on his renomination, but they are vocal nonetheless about wanting the Fed to do more on climate change. What's the or is there a political calculation that you are aware of in the White House?
So we have had, you know, quite a bit of difficulty getting a pulse on where the White House is. You know, our sense is that Chair Powell is very well liked. But as you know, the opposition to him that comes from certain parts of the left has to do with moves the Fed has taken to ease banking regulation, people who wish the Fed would crack down harder on climate. I will say, though, that that is not a universal rallying cry from Democrats. There is this sort of political backdrop, and it gets complicated because the Fed tries very hard to stay out of that spotlight, but they also exist in Washington.
They do indeed. Rachel Siegel, she covers the Federal Reserve and the American economy for the Washington Post. I should say here, just before we wrap up, Chair Powell, as I'm sure from every media organization on the planet, Chair Powell has a standing invitation to come on this program to talk. Rachel, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Wall Street today getting near some real record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Told you about Procter & Gamble raising prices yesterday, mostly personal care products from P&G. Today, it's food. The chief financial officer at Nestle said today that prices are for sure going up the rest of this year and into next, more, he said, than the 4% overall bump that has been seen this year. Of note, simply because Nestle is the world's biggest food conglomerate. And honestly, you walk down the supermarket aisles and you see meat and poultry and fish and eggs are up more than 15% since just before the pandemic hit us. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, those higher prices are forcing some consumer changes.
I ran into Lisa Thomas and her two granddaughters near my neighborhood grocery store in Washington, D.C. They were walking back home carrying several bags, so higher grocery prices were fresh on her mind.
And it's mostly the products we need, milk, eggs, the necessities, even the tissue. The price of tissue has gone up.
Prices for food at home, as the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks the category, are up about 4.5% year over year.
Let me say, they got us by the neck. We're struggling right now, and the prices are still going up.
About half of the overall increase in prices stems from an increase in the costs of beef, pork, and poultry. The Biden administration blames that on consolidation in the meat and poultry processing industry. Bottlenecks and disruptions at just a few companies can have outsized effects in grocery stores all over the country. Veronica Nye, senior economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation, says processors are operating under tough circumstances.
We continue to have issues around labor availability, not just in agriculture or specifically the meat sector, but in the U.S. economy at large.
Plus droughts affecting grazing land for cattle and pandemic-related shutdowns at farms and processors.
And then you look at things like transportation that's, again, impacting lots of different segments. But when you add all of those constraints up, there's a lot of headwinds facing meat prices.
All this turns every trip to the grocery store into a crash course in supply chain economics, says Anna Zeta, who teaches history and runs the food studies program at Virginia Tech.
We don't think too hard about where our food comes from, and that these kinds of moments sometimes shed a little bit of light on that complexity and make people pause and reflect on how is it that, you know, the price of my food is so tied to these massive shipping barges crossing the ocean.
Americans spend relatively little of their income on food compared to the rest of the world, Zeta says, and that can insulate them from noticing changes in food prices, especially if they are middle class or wealthier. But thanks to the pandemic and the effects of climate change,
the insulation that we have is thinning, is weakening, and that people, you know, in the so-called first world will be feeling these impacts more.
And when people start to feel those price impacts, they tend to change their shopping habits, at least in the short term. Amy Bentley is a professor of food studies at New York University.
So, for instance, if they prefer steak and can afford it, they may shift to hamburger. Or if they particularly like a brand name product, they might shift to a cheaper generic product.
That's exactly what Washington, D.C. resident Lisa Thomas says she's been doing.
I won't buy the steaks if they're not on sale anymore. And my grandkids, they love the steak fajitas because they like to enjoy cutting the steak up, making the fajitas, putting it in the tacos.
Most of these changes tend to be short-term, says NYU's Amy Bentley. But the culture of food, and in the U.S., that means the culture of meat, is hard to change. Because for most people, food is more than just sustenance.
Changing your food habits too much can eliminate that comfort element of food or produce stress because you're no longer eating your familiar foods in your familiar ways.
Which is why food prices will likely have to stay elevated for quite a while before Americans change the way they eat. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve's Beige Book was out today, the central bank's eight times a year look at this economy, broken down into the areas covered by the Fed's 12 regional banks. And in the notes provided by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, which covers basically everything west of the Rocky Mountains, one finds this sentence. Crop yields on tree fruit, wheat, and grapes were lower due to warmer temperatures and water shortages. As it happens, the entire state of California is now in a drought emergency, so Governor Gavin Newsom declared yesterday. Marketplace's Samantha Fields finds herself on the Make the Rest of the Country Care desk today.
What happens in California does not stay in California, not when it comes to drought.
It's our largest agricultural producing state in the country. Fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, California produces over 90% of our production by value.
Daniel Munch, an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation, says California also produces a lot of the country's dairy. So
drought has a major impact on the ability for the rest of our states and the rest of our consumers across the country to have access to those products.
So far, Munch says American consumers haven't really been feeling the effects of the drought in California yet. But Tapan Patek, an agricultural climate scientist at the University of California, Merced, says the longer the drought goes on, the more likely that is to change.
We could potentially see reduction in the availability of the fruits and vegetables that's consumed by people every day.
Things like lettuce, lemons, avocados, and all sorts of nuts.
At the same time, we could potentially see higher food prices.
And Americans are generally used to pretty low food prices, says Jennifer Schmidt at the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota.
That's not going to be able to continue in a climate-changed world.
As extreme drought and other extreme weather become more common,
maybe we need to reconsider our priorities of what we should be growing and how we're meeting our food needs.
Like, maybe it's not sustainable to expect to find tomatoes and squash and apples everywhere all year round for cheap. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Mopping floors at midnight.
Somebody's got to do it, right? First, though, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 152 today, 0.4%, finished at 35,609. The NASDAQ was down 7 points. We'll call that flat. 15,121. The S&P 500 added 16 points, almost 0.4%. 45.36. The CEO of Canadian National Railway announced today he is retiring. Shares gained 5.2%. Ouch, right? That's kind of hurt. One of the big losers today was NASDAQ, not the index, but the company that runs the exchange. Its third quarter earnings were okay, but not okay enough for the market. Shares in NASDAQ fell 4.6%. Bonds down as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note bumping up 1.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Orca Security. If you have anything to do with the cloud, building cloud systems, managing cloud security, or using the cloud every day, you'll want to listen to Cloud Security Reinvented. Hosted by Hall of Fame CSO Andy Ellis, Cloud Security Reinvented explores how the cloud has fundamentally altered security practices. Guests from across the technology landscape share their insight in this can't-miss weekly podcast, found on all your favorite platforms. Cloud Security Reinvented by Orca Security.
The climate crisis is here. Time is slipping away to stop the worst effects of a warming planet, and the world needs solutions. Hosted by me, Molly Wood, our new podcast, How We Survive, dives deep into the economics, the tech, and the human stories behind those solutions. From billionaires bankrolling lithium mines to radical environmentalists hoping to destroy industrial civilization to business rivalries so fierce that one CEO was dragged off a plane by federal authorities, How We Survive is following the money to the end of the world because our survival might depend on it. Be sure to go listen and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I would give you an update here on the latest machinations around the Biden administration's two big infrastructure plans being batted about in Congress. But A, what's in and out of favor is changing almost by the minute. And B, those changes are being covered, well, everywhere. So let's do something else, shall we? The Internal Revenue Service, perhaps. Democrats are changing our proposal to help the IRS crack down on people and businesses who owe taxes. Originally, the Dems' plan was for new reporting requirements on bank deposits and withdrawals totaling more than $600. Now, $10,000. Thing is, President Biden's spending plans were going to be paid for in part by the IRS being able to collect unpaid taxes. So, how's that going to work now? Marketplace's Amanda Peacher is on that one.
The Biden administration wants to raise revenue by focusing on what's called the tax gap. Steve Rosenthal with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center explains.
It's the difference between taxes that are paid and taxes that should have been paid.
The government fails to collect around 15% of taxes that are owed each year, says Natasha Sarin with the U.S. Treasury Department.
That was about $600 billion last year.
Sarin says most of that is from the very wealthy.
And the top 1% are responsible for almost 30% of unpaid taxes in this country.
Forcing dishonest taxpayers to pony up is a big part of the Biden administration's plan to fund social programs.
It is a critical pillar to pay for the plan.
Chuck Maher is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, but he says increasing the reporting threshold to $10,000 won't make much of a difference, because the IRS has the most to gain from collecting on wealthy tax cheaters.
The target is for people who are higher up.
For this to work, the IRS is also going to need more resources. Rosenthal with Urban Brookings points out that the IRS has taken on a lot of new programs lately, like monthly child tax credit deposits.
COVID relief. We're asking too much and giving the IRS too little.
So the plan includes a bigger budget for more auditors and computer technology to catch evaders and make them pay. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Hey, how's your burnout level? You holding up all right, or do you maybe need a break? I'm asking because Wall Street kind of looks like it does need a break. That is, there was a memo out at Citigroup this week that said people ought to avoid scheduling meetings at lunchtime and to cut most meetings from an hour to 45 minutes. And earlier this year, the company banned Zooms on Fridays, explicitly talking about burnout. Now, finance is notoriously stressful, well compensated, too, for that stress, it has to be said. But if Wall Street is rethinking how it does business, you can bet other industries are already working on it, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
Brian June worked as an investment banking analyst in Chicago for a couple years right after he got out of college in 2019. The pay was high, but he was at the office till 9 or 10 every night, then often worked at home till the wee hours. Then came the pandemic.
Even more work, less camaraderie.
June quit in February. He's now working for a startup and says in his circle, finance has lost some of its allure for the young and ambitious.
There are like other jobs out there besides banking that you can make similar amounts of money and you're not pulling your hair out at 2 a.m.
Tech is a big competitor for talent, and the pandemic has upended attitudes about work-life balance.
It forced a reckoning in finance that was long overdue.
Callie Williams-Yost is a business strategist who specializes in flexible work. She says Citigroup's meeting limit is a big step for Wall Street, but remote work has demanded companies draw these kinds of lines.
Because the traditional boundaries of a workplace were no longer putting up the guardrails.
For communications professional Katie Shank in D.C., that meant back-to-back Zoom meetings from 8 till 6, practically every day for the first few months of remote work.
I, at one point, actually had to set up my computer in the kitchen so that I could have my fiancé bring me food sometimes.
That's counterproductive, says Bhushan Sethi with business service firm PwC.
I mean, bad meetings are a cancer in an organization. They can disengage people.
He says as we move to more hybrid work arrangements, setting clear goals for meetings and allowing time for other types of interaction is even more important. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We told you about this when the report came out last week, that in August, 3% of the American workforce just quit. 4.3 million people said, you can take this job and, well, maybe not quite that, but look, more than a year and a half into this pandemic economy, a whole lot of people are jumping new jobs in new fields, maybe, or new careers entirely. And the same thing goes for people who were laid off or furloughed or had to leave their jobs to take care of their family. But rather than returning to what was at restaurants or in retail or healthcare or office work, they want something else. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Anyone who has anything to do with the nightmare of hiring workers right now can talk a torrent about this wave of resignations.
Think about the great resignation. It's just been harder to fill the jobs that existed before.
Ray Sanza crunches the numbers at Homebase, which helps manage payroll and HR for 100,000 small businesses, including lots of restaurants and Main Street retailers.
People are switching industries. Think about folks that can go take customer service jobs at tech companies, for example. They don't want to come back to these jobs at the current wage rate with some of the public health risks.
That's what's happened at Chris Knudsen's business, Well 80, a popular brew pub in Olympia, Washington. It shut down, reopened for takeout, and only got back to full capacity a few months ago.
A lot of people that worked for us started working in other industries. One of our former managers is working as an apprentice Finnish carpenter. Former employee that's working as an executive assistant.
One kitchen worker who's moved on is Kayleen Taylor. She's 38 and transitioned to restaurant work after a career as a paralegal. She'd worked her way up to an assistant manager position when the pandemic hit. She got laid off, got called back part-time, laid off, and rehired again.
Couldn't do enough hours, make enough money. Emotionally, it was very rewarding. Physically, the older you get, the harder it is to be mopping floors at midnight.
So she quit.
And I decided to go back to school, master's program in psychology.
Another person who isn't looking back is Dave Harris. He's 30 and was working as a mechanic at a Porsche dealership in Parsippany, New Jersey, when he got laid off at the start of the pandemic.
I'm very tall. I'm 6'6". It's kind of uncomfortable to work on cars. And the money really wasn't as good as I thought it would be either. You know, whenever I told people that I worked for a Porsche dealership, they're always like, oh, wow, do you drive a Porsche? And I'm like, no.
This summer, an insurance company hired him as an auto damage claims adjuster.
What attracted me to it is that I know the ins and outs of how cars work, how they're repaired. I know the industry. Benefits are really good. The pay is really good.
About $54,000 a year, nearly double what he made fixing cars. And the pandemic has turned things upside down for younger people just starting out. Jade Chavez is 20. She graduated high school in Wichita, Kansas, and moved to New York City to start a modeling career.
Within a month, the pandemic broke out. Trader Joe's was empty, and then the subway wasn't safe. And ultimately, that brought me back to Wichita.
She worked low-wage retail jobs, decided college was off the table financially. And a few months ago, she hit the road. She's now volunteering on an organic livestock farm in southern Oregon.
it feels like a safer way to travel and try to get life experiences, to kind of come into adulthood in a world that's not very kind to young adults right now.
Now, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence of workers shifting jobs and exploring new careers as the pandemic continues and the economy struggles to reopen. But Peter Capelli, director of the Wharton School's Center for Human Resources, says aside from a spike in people quitting their jobs, there's not a lot of statistical evidence, like, for instance, rising community college enrollment, to show this is a big new trend.
There's just an awful lot of churn in the workforce, and there's an awful lot of turnover. And we hear a lot of stories about people who say they're looking for something different. We don't have a lot of information to see whether they're actually doing it.
Capelli says a similar thing happened after 9/11. A lot of people said they wanted to radically change their work lives and find more meaningful careers. But it's not clear a lot of them did. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a couple of more anecdotal economic gems from the Beige Book. In the St. Louis Fed's report, employee attendance is such an issue that a big retailer plans to raffle off a car to seasonal employees who show up regularly. In West Central Minnesota, at a business conference last month, every attendee raised their hand saying they are currently trying to hire people. And in Atlanta, as we have reported on this program, the worst labor shortages, nurses leaving or moving to get better schedules or better pay. I'm telling you, jobs is the whole smash in this economy right now. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. This was technically Friday, and I'm not sure how I missed it, history guy that I am. But 20 years ago this month, the Enron scandal broke wide open. For those who don't remember it, first of all, Google. But second of all, basically one of, if not the biggest financial frauds this country has ever seen. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Tirado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. You know, we are always trying to learn more about you. And so we're hoping you can complete a short anonymous survey, less than 5 minutes, I promise. They help us, these surveys do, learn more about our audience so we can serve them, which is to say you, better. Go to AmericanPublicMedia.org/survey, and we would especially love to hear from those of you who we've never heard from before. Again, it's AmericanPublicMedia.org/survey, and thanks.